Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me, my mother, Caroline Kilburn, who's also my co-host. So we're recording this on November 7th of 2020. Our guest today, this is a very timely book because our guest today is Jeff Foster, author of For Which We Stand, How Our Government Works and Why It Matters. Jeff is an advanced placement government and politics teacher at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. After the tragedy that occurred at his school in February 2018, many students credited Mr. Foster with giving them the tools that inspired the Never Again movement and spawned the March for Our Lives. Jeff continues to motivate and inspire his students to become active participants in government. He believes that one person can make a difference no matter their age, and boy, are we seeing that this week. And Jeff lives in Boynton Beach, Florida, with his wife, Lauren, and two daughters. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And there's no question that every vote counts is in full display right now in America.
Oh, wow. It sure has. Well, here in Fairfield, Iowa, our last mayoral election was a tie. And then we had to have a revote, and I think it ended up being won by one vote.
There's something very similar down here right now. There's a city north of me. There's a city commissioner race that is a one vote difference. So they're doing a recount right now, actually.
Wow.
It happens more often than people think. Yeah.
Yeah, and yes, it really does. And so any time, you know, I've known people who said, voting doesn't really matter, but particularly in local races, it can make a huge difference. But even, you know, when a whole nationwide race comes down to kind of a handful of votes, that's kind of amazing. So, Jeff, For Which We Stand is like a graphic, what would you call it? A graphic textbook almost. About how government works.
The goal was to it's geared towards elementary school and middle school kids, but as you've seen, it's really for anybody. But the goal was to make it, if it is used in schools, to make it something that kids will want to pick up. So as opposed to the normal, I mean, as a 12th grade teacher of advanced placement kids, you would think my kids are dying for knowledge, and they are. But the hardest thing to do is to have them read the textbook. You know, here's your book. And, you know, ultimately at the end of the year, when I give them like the post game, like write me a little letter as you're leaving the door, what would you tell future students? They all say, read the textbook, because they're just not interesting. Kids aren't engaged in them. So the goal of this book was to make it just that, you know, an interactive, illustrated, fun fact textbook that, you know, you could easily find whatever you're looking for, whether you want to read the whole thing or just, you know, I've had a lot of friends, as you can imagine, in the last week say, we've used your book to read the Electoral College just to make sure we understand what's going on again. And thanks for those four pages. And I'm like, no problem. I thought that might be important this year.
Yeah. How long have you been teaching, Jeff?
I'm on just started my third decade of teaching. I'm 21 years at Stoneman Douglas now.
So has there been any difference, do you think, in, you know, they talk about kind of with computers and video and screens that get kids' attention spans aren't as long, and so that you need to do more to grab their attention. Have you noticed that or not?
Yeah, I've noticed it in my classroom. I've noticed it in my house. As you mentioned before, I have two daughters. They're 9 and 14. And, you know, it's when they have downtime, you know, when we used to have downtime, and again, I don't think we're ancient at this point, but we used to go outside. We used to play. We used to, you know, find fun stuff to do ourselves. Now it's like their default is to jump on their phones or go to YouTube and just find some silly video to watch. But as you go around, as we all live our lives, not as much now because of the COVID crisis, we're not out as much. But, you know, even when you're watching, you know, people our age sitting at dinner, you just look at people sitting at dinner, they're both on their phones while they're sitting across from each other at the table. And it's like, guys, why don't we experience life? So, yeah, it is difficult. And we do have rules at the school about phones, but because of the incident that happened at our school, we have a lot of kids that, you know, are very skittish, as you can imagine.
Right.
So we can't really enforce the fact that kids have to be allowed to have their phones on them at all times, because if they have some kind of panic attack, they want to be able to call their loved ones and feel safe and let them know they are safe. You know, unfortunately, we're in kind of a unique situation where who I work with the shooting in February of 2018. So that sort of changed it. But yeah, it's been very difficult for the last probably decade, because every time you look up, whether you're lecturing or whether they're doing group work, invariably their phones kind of sneak out of their pockets and they're on their desk. And these kids can, I actually did an experiment once. I said, guys, let's see who can do this. And so I put my phone number on the board, and they all typed my phone number into their text box. And I said, I'm going to read something to you, and I want you guys to type this back to me. And whoever types it back to me the fastest without looking down at their phones, I'll give 10 points extra credit on the next test too. And literally out of the 30 kids in class, like 20 of them gave me like perfect, you know, verbatim message within like 15 seconds without ever taking their eyes off me, which just shows you how much they use their phone even to look at this point. It's insanity.
So, Mom, you retired from teaching before cell phones were really much of a thing, right?
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what was the big distraction, do you think, for the kids when you were teaching? Which, let's see, when did you retire? What year?
Let's see. 90.
So quite a while ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, quite a while ago. Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. It's hard. There was nothing like having cell phones or anything then. So it was, I don't know. They decided they didn't want to pay attention. They didn't pay attention. And, you know, there wasn't too much you could do about it.
Probably hormones more than anything else.
Yeah, probably. Probably. So how did you become interested in government, Jeff?
I've always been sort of a, you know, an admirer from afar, let's say. And then when I got into teaching, I my parents were always active when I was young. They were big Republicans in South Florida and big Reagan fans. So I sort of knew what was going on even when I was in my teenage years. And my dad was involved in a lot of local areas. Actually, my uncle was a politician in Pennsylvania, actually. So again, there was a little dabbling within the family, and we were definitely an active family in terms of knowing what was going on. But then when I got into teaching and became a social studies teacher, I actually was a geography teacher for a year and a half at Stoneman Douglas. And then our government teacher, AP government teacher, left. And in our school, this isn't as common at all schools, we tend to specialize in one area. And we're not required to do that. We just kind of figure at our school, whenever they decided this, at least in our department, it's better if, you know, Jeff Foster teaches government exclusively all day, then you can become sort of an expert in government. And it really kind of mirrors the government. You know, elected officials might sit on the agricultural committee or the Senate Intelligence Committee, so they become more expert in that area. So I was asked by my department head if I wanted the class at the turn of the century, basically at 2000. And I had a little trepidation because advanced placement class, you know, the scores are posted every year, and there's a lot of pressure on advanced placement teachers. And I was a fairly young teacher at the time. But I embraced it, and it was the greatest decision I made, because I've met so many great kids and so many great educators along the way, and made a lot of connections. And I've been fortunate enough to have a lot of my former students get into the political arena, whether running for office or working as ambassadors for other countries or just working in the bureaucracy. And it's been great. It's been an awesome 20 years. And, you know, unless I hit the lottery this week, it'll be another awesome 20 years to follow, I think. As your mom knows, they don't pay us great, so we got to work well into our, past our retirement year as a teacher.
Right.
Well, maybe you'll be a best-selling author.
Yeah, I hope so. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, I wish I sort of thought of his name. There's a gentleman in Florida that we've interviewed a couple of times who is a professor of political history at a college in the Boca Raton area, I think, and he's written many, many books. I don't think any of them have become bestsellers, but he picks these most fascinating areas of political history that we know so little about. And I feel like there is really room for, well, look at Hamilton and what a hit that was. And there is room for telling these stories in a new and more engaging way. Not just room, but a need for it.
I agree. And as everybody always says, you know, you need to know your history. I mean, I've been shocked as I've gone on this virtual book tour that I've been on for the last, month and a half now, at how many areas of this country don't have civics education. There are so many states where the interviewees have said to me, you know, how often do your kids have, you know, civics in Florida? And I said, well, a minimum of 2 years, and sometimes 3 years, depending on the county. And to a man or a woman, it seems like every second or third person says, well, it's not required in my state. And I'm like, are you serious? And you would think of, you know, geography, world history, American history, civics, that civics would be right at the top, because that is something that obviously we have a direct impact on. I mean, history is important, geography is important, and world history is important, because we don't want to be, you know, repeat stuff that we made mistakes in. But I would think that civics education should be at the, you know, the absolute paramount in terms of learning. And it seems like a lot of states have not made it a priority. Oh. And as I've talked to some of these people, maybe that's because, you know, the government sort of wants us not to pay attention so they can just do, you know, we elect them and then they let us go to sleep for 2 or 4 years. Then they say, please vote for me again. And then they say, all right, go back to YouTube for 2 more years.
You know, so well, yeah, there is, there, you know, government classes were always required in Iowa, as far as I know. They certainly were when I was in high school here. They were when my kids were in high school here. But that's been 20 years. So I'm not absolutely sure what the situation is now.
Let's hope so.
Things have changed in the school system a lot.
Yeah.
You know,
the one thing that I like to say about government is when people complain about the government, it's like, but we are the government, in a sense.
That's correct. And that's my mantra. You can't, if you didn't participate, you can't complain. I mean, it's really that simple. And I think it's interesting that we first started talking about local government races today, because those are even more important than the presidential race. I know the presidential race, they spend billions and billions of dollars, and it looks like we're going to be geared up to spend another $1 billion on these two Senate races in Georgia. They're going to determine the fate of the Senate, who controls it. But still, your mayors and your city commissioners and your state legislatures and your governors have much more of an impact on your daily life. And I think that's really been proven during this COVID crisis, because, you know, the fact that, you know, I happen to live in a county where masks are required, as opposed to, again, maybe, you know, 100 miles north of here, because we're a big state in Florida, where they're not required, and that's all up to the local governments to decide that. So I think people are really starting to realize that who you select for mayor or city commissioner, and ultimately even the governor at the state level, have more of an impact on your lives than does the president, even though the president obviously gets the press and is the singular person that sort of runs the country. Ultimately, in terms of running your life, he doesn't have that much of an impact on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And everyone, really, from your, you know, local city council person clear up to the president, they're really all just people like you and me.
That's correct. Yeah, that's absolutely it. I mean,
and in many ways, no better and no worse.
Sometimes worse, I think. We've seen that full display recently. But, you know, that's what's scary about what's going on right now, is you see people literally starting to arm themselves and go into the streets to talk about, you know, an election result. And the leaders should be responsible enough to say the proper things to stop that from happening. And they just don't seem to be. And I don't want to singularly point out anybody. But
we know who you're talking about.
Yeah, we do. We do. And it's you know, you keep hoping that he will do or say the right thing. I was actually watching a channel this morning, and somebody said something along the lines of, one of the staff members from the White House said, this is his grieving period right now, meaning the president. And eventually, when he comes out the other side, maybe he'll embrace what happened and wish, you know, the president-elect. Well, I know it's not official yet, but it looks by all means that Biden's going to win the presidency. But it's, I hope that happens, but I'm hard-pressed to believe it, because the evidence is the contrary with President Trump. And, you know, it's been a wild 4 years. There's no question about that. And I think, you know, policy wise, I don't really want to get into the conversation about just President Trump, but I don't think he's done a terrible job. And in terms of obviously unifying the country, he has not, you know, been stellar by any stretch. And I really hope that the president-elect, along with, you know, his party and the people who support his party, are willing to try to work with, you know, the Republicans, and the Republicans in turn will do the same, because we really have a lot of healing to do in this country right now.
Oh, absolutely. And I just want to mention a couple things. One is that two of the people that I follow very closely on Twitter and read a lot are people that you would know. David Hogg, is one, and Fred Gutenberg is another.
Yes, both. One of my former student, and we'll call him a Fred now because he still calls me Mr. Foster, which is a little weird. and Fred and I have done a lot of stuff together over the last 2 years. Obviously, it's unimaginable what happened to Fred losing his daughter Jamie up at our school. February 14th of 2018, and Fred and I have collaborated on a lot of stuff, getting public service announcements out there and showing up at places and trying to rally people to vote, to participate, to, you know, give money to causes. Fred's, you know, he's dedicated his life to ending gun violence and supporting good people for office that are going to hopefully change the world for the better. And, you know, again, I my heart goes out to him, and he's been so strong. Him and his family have been incredibly strong during this whole thing. And then David, obviously, is just, you know, he's a spitfire. I mean, he's working 24/7 just to get people to participate. And again, same end game. You know, he wants to put people in office. They're going to try to have common sense gun legislation, and he wants people to participate. And the year I had with David in my class, and the 2 years after, or 2.5 years now, were amazing. I mean, he was one of the most active kids I had, you know, before, you know, we became pseudo famous, or he became real famous actually. But every class when we were discussing something, he would always contribute. And then even beyond that, we'd be done. And I would allow 10 minutes, Monica and Caroline, for the phones to come out at the end. But then Dave would throw his hand up and ask another question, and all the kids would just give a collective sigh, like, not this kid again, you know. But he was always looking for that knowledge. He wanted to know, you know, what happened and why it happened. And I mean, he would pick up his phone at, you know, 1 a.m. after, you know, when we were in the midst of trying to change everything in Tallahassee and Washington, D.C., and call me and ask me a question. Like, my phone would ring, and I've got this thing on my iPhone where it announces the name. So I'd be fast asleep in my bed. All of a sudden I'd hear, David Hogg. And I'm like, oh, geez. So I'd roll over, and it'd be like he was on his 12th cup of coffee and he had like 9 questions for me. So I'm like, all right, buddy, let's go.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jeff Foster, author of For Which We Stand, How Our Government Works and Why It Matters. So we will get into a little bit about your writing process and how you put this book together, but I wanted to say, I was looking up what the margins of victory and how many votes there were in presidential races from the very beginning, and I found a chart that had it. And one thing that was shocking to me was, I didn't realize this, George Washington won the presidency with less than 50,000 votes.
Yeah. There weren't that many voters back then.
There weren't that many voters. And nobody ran against him.
It was just white guys who own property, essentially.
And nobody was running against him. He ran unopposed. So that...
He could have been president for as long as he wanted to be, but he chose to step down after 2 terms because he didn't want it to start out like a kingdom, like obviously England was. He didn't want to have that same monarchy feel. So he, even though they were begging him to stay after 8 years, he said, no, I'm good. And the great thing about Washington, and I've read a lot of books on Washington, and this is pretty common knowledge about Washington, is in his farewell address, he really, you know, said he didn't like political parties. They were called factions back then. And he really like rallied against like ending this, you know, party system that was sprouting up in this country. And obviously he had a lot of foresight because we've seen what's happened, you know, with the two-party system over the last, you know, 2 decades of our lives now.
Now, a friend and I were having an argument the other day, or a debate the other day, because I had said that the electors aren't required, the Electoral College is not actually required to vote for who the people voted for in their state.
You were correct.
That's what I thought.
But the reason it doesn't happen that often, and I can explain Florida the best, because that's obviously what I know the most, because I live here, and this is how most states work it as well, is, and this is just a plain way to explain it to everybody. So we have 29 electoral votes in Florida. So before the election, everybody on the ballot gives their list of electors to basically the governor's office. And then whoever wins the state, those electors are invited in December to cast a ballot for the state that voted. So for instance, we'll just use the two big parties. Biden's people have a list of 29 names of Democrats. The Republicans have a list of 29 names of prominent Republicans. you know, usually donors or people big within the party. And then since Trump won Florida, the Democratic ballot goes in the garbage, Democratic names, and the Republicans are then invited to the governor's mansion. They're all invited on the same day. I believe it's December 6th this year in all 50 states and Washington, D.C., and those people cast the ballot. So could they stray and vote for somebody else? And has it happened? Yes. But has it ever happened to, like, affect the, you know, the results of the election? The answer to that is no. So, but, yeah, so they're not bound in most states. I think it's almost half the states are not bound by law to vote for who the people have basically voted for within that state, because, again, we have 51 separate elections on election night, and unfortunately it's lasting a week plus now, it seems. But generally they do follow the advice of the popular vote, and all 29 votes in Florida will be cast for Donald Trump.
And a state could choose to say that the electoral votes from that state are based, that they don't all have to be for the same person. If 60% of the people voted for one person and 40 for the other, they could split them if a state chose to do that. Is that true?
It's all up to the state legislature. Yeah, it's up to the state legislature. There's a lot of clamoring for that. We've actually seen it this year. There's two states, Maine and Nebraska, that have that division right now. And the way they actually work in those two states, I think, is probably the best way to do it, is each district is worth one electoral vote. And then whoever wins the whole state gets the other two electoral votes, because your electoral votes are based on the number of congressmen and senators you have. So I think you have six votes in Iowa, which means you have four districts and two Senate seats. So if they did it that way in Iowa, let's say Trump won two districts and Biden won two districts, but Trump won the overall state, then it would be 4-2 Trump in Iowa, which makes a heck of a lot more sense than 6-0.
Yeah, yeah. And I understand that there are some states that are changing for next time to where they have pledged that their electoral votes will go to whomever wins the national popular vote.
Yeah, I don't know how that's going to play. I don't know if that's going to be found to be legal or not. Because there's no question the national popular vote is going to go to the Democrat because of the state of California. If you look at the numbers this year, Biden won by over 4 million popular votes. And in California, not coincidentally, he won by over 4 million popular votes. So it'd be literally allowing California to decide for all the other states. The rest of the country is basically a tie every year. And whatever the margin is in California determines the popular vote winner if it's a, you know, if it's a contentious election. So, I mean, I understand the reason for it, because, you know, in the last three times or two times that the two of the last three times Republicans have won, they've lost the popular vote but won the Electoral College. So this is sort of a way for more liberal-leaning states to ensure that the Democrat will get the votes and it will mirror the popular vote. But I don't necessarily agree with that, because I really think it's important that that every vote is counted. But at the same time, I don't think one state should have that much influence on the electoral process, even though they are the largest state.
Yeah, and of course now they have much less influence than they should.
Because that's true, too. Yeah, that's their argument, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
I was wondering what or how and why the Electoral College was established.
It was basically established to just ensure that you know, uninformed people wouldn't select a bad president. It was basically, you know, a stopgap, a safety, if you will, safety valve, that if the regular, ordinary people picked maybe some famous farmer that lived in the middle of nowhere, that the Electoral College could then go back and fix it. The good news is that the Electoral College has never changed the winner of the election. So whoever is supposed to win the Electoral College has actually won the election. So that's a good thing. The reason it hasn't changed, more importantly, I think, is because there has to be a constitutional amendment to actually change the Electoral College. And the small states just won't agree to it because, again, if we go to a straight popular vote, all of the campaigning, I know it takes place in about 12 swing states right now, but all of the campaigning would just take place in the major cities around the country. They would go from Los Angeles to San Diego to Dallas to Houston to Miami to Chicago to Milwaukee, et cetera. And there'd be so many states that just like dropped, you know, paraphernalia out of a plane as they flew, literally the flyover states, as people like to talk about. So that's probably why it won't change. But the ironic thing about the question about the Electoral College being set up initially is I just told you it was to ensure that, like, dumb people or farmers wouldn't put them in there. But then in the same breath, we talked before that at the beginning, only white rich males were voting. So that they put the stopgap there, the safety there, safety net there for a reason, but it was almost unneeded because at the time, white rich men were controlling the election anyways.
I thought part of it was also that the more agrarian states wanted to be sure that they had, you know, that they weren't overrun by the more populous states.
No question. Yes, it's always been a small state, big state argument, whether you're talking about representation in Congress or you're talking about the Electoral College. But they were, you know, there were other things put into place early as well, like senators, which we now elect, obviously, every 6 years. The state governments elected senators until 1913 in this country. So the state legislatures used to pick governors, which, again, was sort of a safety net against the common man making a mistake in putting, you know, an unqualified senator in office. Although I would argue pretty adamantly there's been a lot of unqualified senators in office over the last 240 years in this country.
Yeah, yep. Okay, so how long did you spend writing For Which We Stand?
It was actually fairly quick. You know, the goal of the book, they asked me in the summer of 2019, in August, to write the book. And the goal was to have it ready for the election season this year, obviously. I thought it would be a great time to bring out a government book during the election. And initially, when they called me, Scholastic, and when we talked about it, their timetable was a lot faster than I envisioned. You know, after we agreed, they're like, okay, we'd like to have the first half of the book. So this is like August 1st. They're like, we'd like to have the first half of the book by maybe the end of October and the book completed by Thanksgiving. And I kind of gulped and I said, well, I am a full-time high school teacher, so it's going to be a little difficult. So I managed to extend it till about January, and I believe I finished it right at the beginning of January. So I worked on it every weekend. Any downtime at school I had, I would stay after school some days so I could just have the peace and quiet of my classroom. And the coolest thing about it, and this is, you know, the only book I've ever written up to this point, and I hope there's others, was going from that Word program and seeing the first copy of it. So I envisioned what it was going to be the finished product was going to look like, and I had ideas of graphs and charts and pictures and infographics, etc. But to go from, you know, just staring at a Word document to getting the first, you know, rough copy in the mail and seeing what it was going to look like, I think they call them the galleys, I believe, was pretty phenomenal. And you know, I couldn't be prouder of the way it turned out. So, you know, so the whole thing was about five and a half months.
Well, I think I got a pretty early version of it because there's a lot of pages that have like frames with Art TK, which I'm assuming means Art to Come.
Yes, I have that copy as well. Yeah, that's the one I first got, and I'm like, all right. But then I'm like, wait a minute, I hope they fill this in, you know.
So, you very involved in how it was being laid out, or was that completely in somebody else's?
Obviously the illustrations, I'm not an artiste by any stretch. I had a hand in that as well. You know, some of the finer touches, there's no question, without Scholastic, it wouldn't look as great as it looks. But I was, you know, from every time there was a decision to be made, they brought me in on it and said, is this okay? And when I wanted something and thought of the fun facts to add or a specific graph or chart, like there were certain things when I would call for, like how a bill becomes a law or like the structure of the courts. You know, if you go online and Google that stuff, there's 9 million different things. And they literally just said to me, can you just draw it out on a piece of paper for us and just send it to us? And then we'll punch it up and then you can comment and see if it's good. And so I have some of the rough drawings, and believe me, they're rough drawings. But Julie McLaughlin, who did the illustrations, just did a magnificent job. And the back and forth with the editors and the constant communication was great. Even to the very end, when it was complete, being able to actually have a hand in who got to read the book for Audible was something that me and my daughters actually did together. We sat around and we listened to the five, you know, voice actors kind of go over it. And we chose the lady that we wanted to read it. And, you know, I'm happy with that as well. So, yeah, we were very involved from the start. And I'm so appreciative of Scholastic for keeping us involved. I mean, obviously, I don't know the process now I know the process of writing a book, but I didn't know how involved I was going to be in all the steps, but they kept me very involved from the beginning to the end.
So it's hard to imagine this book getting into Audible because the graphic element is so, you know, such an important part of it. How does that convert to an Audible book?
I was skeptical myself. You know, they've got a nice 4th of July drum beat in the background as they read the beginning and then the foreword by Yolanda King and then my foreword. And then they just, you know, read through the book. But yeah, there's no, yeah, they don't describe pictures or anything. So it's people have purchased it and people say they enjoy it. I haven't listened to it from cover to cover yet. I've actually got a few Audible credits, so maybe I should just get one as I jog so I can listen to it. But I haven't heard the whole thing yet, but it seems like it's good. But there's no question the actual hardcover book would be much better because as my eyes have deteriorated over the years, I prefer Audible books over hard books now as well, although I do have both. But when I go for a walk or a jog or a workout, I always am listening to a Nelson DeMille book or a Tom Clancy book or some kind of, you know, biography or autobiography I'm listening to. And it's just much because I can go from the car to the gym to cleaning the house with my earbuds on and I can listen to the book and get through a heck of a lot more pages than I can by reading it. So, but yeah, I think this one for sure translates better in your hand as opposed to on Audible, but it still works on Audible. If it didn't, I guess they wouldn't put it in the format.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jeff Foster, author of For Which We Stand, How Our Government Works and Why It Matters. Caroline, do you have some more questions?
Well, I was just wondering if any of your students had seen the what this book is. I mean, did any of them get a chance to look at it as you developed it, or?
I actually, that's a great question. Yeah, I did. As I was a little bit, I don't want to say shy, because shy is definitely not my personality trait, but I was guarded when I was writing the book. You know, the part of it, I'm acutely aware that even though I'm well known in the area for, you know, I've moderated debates and stuff down here before. So people know me as sort of a I don't want to say a political guru, but they trust my sense when it comes to government and politics down here. But I'm acutely aware that Scholastic would have never asked me to write a book unless the tragedy happened at our school when I, you know, my students then became well known, which in turn made me a little bit more well known. And that's why they reached out to me. So I was a little, you know, I didn't want people to feel like I was, you know, capitalizing on our tragedy, I guess you could say. So that was a little, the first thing I kind of had to get over when I decided to write the book. But as it got closer to being released, I actually did start showing my classroom. I would tell them, you know, and it was weird. I teach 7 classes during the day, and this is obviously pre-pandemic. And, you know, some of them you're closer with than others, and you have a little bit more dying time than others, and you're a little bit more talkative with certain classes. So I did say, guys, you know, I'm writing a children's book for Scholastic, and I'd be excited. I'd get something during class period, and they're like, can we see it? So I'd throw it on the projector through my computer, and they're like, this looks amazing. And then, you know, so, and then I actually, Biden was just declared the winner, by the way. People are blowing up my phone right now.
Oh, wow.
So it literally just happened. I got like 19 text messages as we're talking.
By the AP,
so
that, or who did it?
I just got Biden won by about 14 people on my text. So I don't have the AP. Okay.
Yep.
So, wow. I don't know what state they gave them, but actually when I got to the what can I do section, which is obviously, you know, what my students did when it came to the March for Our Lives, I actually talked to them a lot, my former students, and I sort of sent all of the pre-copy to them to see if I like missed anything, because here they are organizing a march that had over a million people nationwide, you know, in 1 month. So who better than them to make sure I'm not missing anything on organizing or educating people. So I would use David and Emma and those people as sort of, you know, my other editors to make sure I was good. And I actually do have a quote in there from Matt Deitch, who was one of the content creators of the March for Our Lives. And he's the only one that I mentioned by name in the book. So, but all of my former students, they got copies of the book for me, and they're all proud of me. And, you know, and they're hoping that it becomes a big success, so then I can retire before I'm 100 years old.
Well, before we close, would you like to read a little bit from For Which We Stand?
Sure.
Okay.
How about that section I just mentioned? Actually, I'll do the what can I do section for the youth.
Perfect.
All right. Learning how the government works is just the first step to becoming and staying an active citizen. Even if you aren't eligible to vote just yet, there are so many things you can get to do, get people involved, raise awareness, and engage your government at multiple levels. Voting is one of the most important things you can do as a citizen. It is our civic duty to elect fellow citizens working for the government who will represent our best interests. But don't worry, if you're not 18 yet, anyone of any age can help others register to vote. This can be very easy because most states now have online registration. You can also volunteer for a political campaign, even if you can't vote for the candidate yourself. Visit the websites of the candidates you support and sign up through their volunteer forms. Just make sure that the campaign doesn't have any age restrictions and that your parents or guardians are okay with you volunteering. Look for rallies in your area. If you're able to attend, make banners and posters supporting the candidate's ideas to bring along. You can also help educate fellow citizens by spreading positive information about the candidate you support, from mobilizing voters through phone calls, going door-to-door in your local neighborhood, or even putting a yard sign outside where you live. There are many ways to spread your candidate's message. And don't forget about social media. You can create hashtags, memes, or GIFs to help raise awareness for your preferred candidates and your favorite causes, or share those that others have created. This is the part from Matt Deitch, actually. Starting with an achievable goal is key. Matt Deitch, a chief strategist from the March for Our Lives and one of my former students, usually highlights Dr. King's letter from Birmingham jail when he speaks to his students, or he speaks to students, excuse me. Dr. King's letter was a powerful statement made through a small protest. The march that led to his arrest had fewer than 50 people. Then Matt asked the students, who here thinks they can organize less than 50 people? This is a great reminder that you don't have to do something big in order to make a difference. Stay engaged in the political process by paying attention to the news. It's easy to keep updated by following news networks, politicians, and political reporters on social media, by watching political debates, and by researching trending political topics. Social media platforms can be used to spread news, organize, and connect with others who share your ideas. Some activists have even used hashtags to bring people together and start movements, and that was actually how we started our movement at school. That's a little sidebar there. Spread the word about your cause to other people in your community and other local or state officials who might support your idea. The more people who know about what you're trying to do, the better. Petitions can be used to change policies by raising a specific concern so other citizens can become aware of an issue. Create a document stating what you'd like to change and ask others to sign it showing their support. When creating a petition, be sure to develop a clear and concise argument about what you're trying to change and have a goal for how many signatures you want to get. And then in the sidebar, it says, in 2019, a group of kids started a petition to close schools the day after Halloween. They got more than 1 million signatures. The size of the petition caused the media to cover the story, and it could result in the closure of schools on November 1st in the future. Like everything else, petitions are much easier to promote today because social media allows you to reach more people at a much faster rate. Marches and protests have been part of the American political process for centuries. The goal of these events is to raise awareness for your cause and ultimately to get legislators to pass laws to benefit your group. Marches and protests are both protected by the First Amendment's freedom of assembly and freedom of petition clauses. After the tragedy at my high school, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, our students organized the March for Our Lives, the largest student-led march in American history, in just over a month with the goal to end senseless gun violence. So then it's followed by a massive chart of the timeline of progress that goes for 4 pages, and it talks about anything from, you know, the Seneca Falls Convention for Women all the way up to, you know, the March for Our Lives is one of the last thing on there. It goes from 1700s to 2018 and that's the end of the book before I give the conclusion, sort of the last inspirational message for the book.
Well, how did you decide which events to go on this timeline?
That we really wanted to be really inclusive. I mean, Earth Day is on here. The Stonewall riots is on here. Vietnam War protests are on here. Rosa Parks, the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Labor and Standards Act, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, even mentioned something like Rachel Carlson publishes Silent Spring, a book about the dangers of using pesticides. So we tried to cover all angles from gay marriage to race relations to, you know, anything and everything that where people came together to make a difference. So Black Lives Matter, when they founded in July 13th, 2013, is in there as well. So obviously that's you know, prophetic when it came to this past summer. But even the arms race is covered. The arms race occurring between the Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War leads 1 million people to protest against nuclear weapons in New York City Central Park on June 12, 1982. So we really tried to, you know, not miss any groups when we talked about these movements, because we wanted to let kids know and let anybody that reads the book know that, you know, no issue is too small, and there are people out there that support you. It's just up to you to articulate your ideas correctly, and you can get people to follow you.
Wow. Well, Jeff, I want to thank you. I'm going to let you go because I'm sure you've got people you want to talk to about the results of the election. And it's just kind of a thrill for me to be talking to you at this moment when this result came in. That was kind
of
cool.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I was like, why is my phone? Why are all these people calling me? And I thought everyone would text. I'm like, okay, got it.
Wow. All right. Well, Mom, do you have a quote for us?
Well, I was looking at different quotes in this book I have. And of course, the most famous one probably is by Abraham Lincoln and his Gettysburg Address, the government by of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth.
A good one.
Yeah, that is a good one. So thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Monica. Caroline, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For the next part of the show, Caroline and I are going to do something a little different. We're not talking to an author, but we're talking about a book that was published, what, about 20 years ago?
September 1999.
Right. So 21 years ago. Why don't you tell us what this book is, Mom, and why you wanted to talk about it today?
Well, this book is called Through My Eyes, and it's written by Ruby Bridges. And most people probably don't even remember her, but she was a little girl that went to an all-white elementary school in first grade. And she didn't really know what was going on, but it was a terribly difficult time in the South right then. And so this is the story of that and where she went from there after that, and you know what she did with her life. And it's an interesting book. It really is. It's called Through My Eyes by Ruby Bridges.
And it's a book that's suitable for young readers.
Oh, yes, I think so.
But, you know, it has a lot of pictures, a lot of photographs, and it's mostly basically the story of what she remembers of those years. She was the first African-American child to desegregate the all-white William France Elementary School in Louisiana during the New Orleans school desegregation on November 14th, 1960 is when she started school there. And there were four girls who were starting first grade who were the first ones to desegregate the schools. But three of them were at one school, and she was the only one at William France. And just to think about what that would have been like.
Well, she was the only one in the class.
For most of the school year.
Yeah, because the other parents didn't, they were either afraid to send their kids because of the violence that was going on outside, or they just didn't want to. Now, actually, in 1954 was when the Supreme Court outlawed school segregation in Brown versus Board of Education in Topeka, Kansas. So this was quite a while after that. I mean, this is in 1960. So, you know, no one had done anything. They hadn't done anything yet, but the group decided that they were going to do something now and start something. So, and she was a brave little girl, but she didn't realize how brave she was. I think.
Really? I mean, the law required the schools to start desegregating, and they allowed them to do it gradually. So they were going to do first grade, and then when those kids went on to second, there'd be more first graders and so forth. But there was such a horrible backlash against it. Like you said, many of the white parents took their kids out of the school. Some did not. And that required a lot of courage also.
Oh, absolutely.
But even the ones who were there were kept in a different classroom from Ruby until fairly far on in the school year when maybe there weren't violent protesters outside the school every single day. She had to be accompanied to school by marshals, by federal mm-hmm. marshals.
Right. And her teacher was a very compassionate person and a perfect teacher for her. And but the principal, the principal of this school was not. She did not like this at all.
No, so she was not supportive of it.
No.
And the teacher got a lot of flack too. She was kept pretty private about what she was doing. She didn't tell people that she was teaching mm-hmm. Ruby. And she was an outsider. She was not from New Orleans. And she didn't stay long after this year, after this school year.
No, she didn't. She moved. Moved back to up north someplace. But, yeah, and the interesting thing was that she really grew to love this little girl, and this little girl loved her. And so the next year, when Ruby went to second grade, she ran right up to the room. She thought that's where she would be going, you know, to see her teacher. But it didn't happen. Of course, she was gone by then.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So, but she was really courageous. And there was some other people that were helpful to her. There was a psychiatrist, a gentleman who talked to her and, you know, helped her through some of the things that she had to deal with. So, but basically she was alone in this school, in this schoolroom, no other students in the schoolroom when it started.
And the teacher wasn't allowed to communicate with her parents either after the first day. Her mother went with her the first day, and after
mm-hmm.
that she was really, but you have to give a lot of credit to her mother and father.
Absolutely. Oh, my gosh.
So how did Ruby get chosen to do this?
Well, I'm not sure.
There's a section in the book there that talks about they gave a test to all of the kindergartners, all the African-American kindergartners. And, of course, they were called colored at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now we wouldn't refer to them.
No, I'm not going to use that word. No,
but very few of the African American students passed this test. It was a very not a fair test.
I'm sure it was skewed for right.
So, but she was one of the few that did.
Yeah, because she had a lot of innate intelligence, and you know, the fact that she could get through all of this and not just go bananas, you know, was really something, because people were screaming at her and stuff, and they were throwing stuff when she was in the way to school, even though those marshals are with her. And, you know, I just can't imagine that going on. It's just unbelievable. Well, it is an interesting book, and you know, it's especially interesting now because, the difficulty that we're having in some respects.
And Through My Eyes by Ruby Bridges is available online on Amazon, for example, if you're interested in taking a look at it.
But then it has, this one page has, starts out with the Supreme Court Segregation Act, and then it goes on the way down to Dr. Martin Luther King is assassinated, and all the things that happened between those two times. So it's a history book, really, is what it is.
And
that's why it'd be so good for students to read, I would think.
I would think so, too. Do you want to read a little bit from it for us? This is from Through My Eyes by Ruby Bridges.
Okay, I'm going to read this part where this child psychiatrist, Robert Coles, came into my life that winter. At the time, he was a young man in the Air Force stationed right outside of New Orleans. On his way to a medical conference, and one morning, he came upon the mob outside my school and noticed me being led into the building by the marshals. At that point, he became interested in me and wondered how I could go through such an ordeal. Soon afterward, he went to the NAACP to offer his help. Dr. Coles felt that it would be easier for me to endure the stress if I had someone to talk to outside of my family. Dr. Coles met regularly with me. He also met the three other girls from McDonald, number 19. That's the other school that had some colored girls in it. And with the white children from each integrated school. Every week, he would come to my house with his tape recorder. He would ask how I was doing, and I mostly told him I was doing fine. Then he would pull out crayons and would ask me to draw pictures of myself or the school or some of the people in my life. After what he would talk about how the picture showed what I was feeling, even if I couldn't put it into words. I think those pictures helped him to understand me. I enjoyed the time I spent with Dr. Coles because an important man was coming to visit me and color with me, and that made me feel special. His wife was a caring person and often came to the house with him. She would always bring something special for me when she came. My mother taught Mrs. Cole how to cook gumbo, and they became good friends. Dr. Coles later wrote about me in a number of books and articles, along with stories of other children of crisis. He seemed to admire how well I held up through the Franz school experience, but he was always curious about what kept me going.
And he did. He wrote a book for kids called The Story of Ruby Bridges, and that was republished in 2010 as a special anniversary edition. And is also available for sale. So, this is such a turning point. And when you look at those pictures and you read about the things that the people were doing to try and stop this one little girl from going to school, it's hard to believe looking back at it now.
Well, what puzzles me is she wasn't going to be in a class with any of their children. She was in class by herself. She and her teacher were the only ones in the class.
Yeah.
So if there were other children in the school, that there could have been, other children in the school, they wouldn't have been anything to do with her anyway. She would have eaten by herself, and that was what was so interesting, that they wouldn't even allow that, because it was the parents that were so abusive outside. It wasn't people that came in that, I don't think that came in from other places. It was the parents of the children that would be in that school, but they weren't anymore. They took them out. So
the degree of hatred is just, it's mind-blowing. Now, do you remember reading about this at the time? Because there was an article in Life magazine, and there was a picture by a drawing by Norman Rockwell.
Yes, I remember that.
You do remember that?
I remember the drawing, yes. And I don't remember reading too much about it. But I also remember, and I also wasn't aware that John Steinbeck was interested in this story, and that he wrote.
Yeah, what did he write about her? Can you find that?
Yeah. The author John Steinbeck was driving through New Orleans with his dog Charlie when he heard about the racist crowds that gathered outside the Franz School each morning to protest its integration. He decided to go see what was happening. He especially wanted to see a group of women who came to scream at me and at the few white children who crossed the picket lines and went to school. At the time, I didn't know that there were other children in the building. We were kept apart. The women were known as the cheerleaders, and their foul language even shocked a man as worldly as Mr. Steinbeck. I never met John Steinbeck, but he seemed to sympathize with what I was going through. He wrote about me in a book called Travels with Charlie. Steinbeck left his dog and his truck in a parking lot. He didn't want to take them to France, where his dog could get hurt or his car damaged. Instead, he took a cab. Fearing the protesters would wreck his car, the driver didn't take Steinbeck all the way to the school, but left him a few blocks away. Steinbeck never knew my name. My name and the names of the girls at the McDonald School were never mentioned on television or in the newspapers, which was interesting, really, when you think about it, in today's world.
Yeah.
The press tried to protect us, and that was good. I would say that was a hurrah for the press.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. So yeah, he was interested in this and evidently saw her going into school when he went to see it. So artist Norman Rockwell was inspired by paragraphs in Travels with Charlie, and he was inspired to paint a picture called The Problem We All Live With. It was published in the January 14, 1964 issue of Look magazine. And it shows this little girl in a little white dress and holding some books and walking in behind these two big men and two other big men behind her walking into school. And it shows on the wall back of her that the tomato had been thrown there and splashed on the wall. I don't know.
Well, I know. And Ruby Bridges became an activist later in life, and she won the John Steinbeck Award. And I'm trying to find out who gave that award. It was a university. So I think it was an annual award that she won in 2015.
Well, let's see.
San Jose State University. That's who it was. Okay. Yeah.
And she did connect with her teacher later on. Somehow they got back together. So reunited with Mrs. Henry.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For many years, my first grade teacher and I were lost to each other. When she saw the book, she was able to contact me through the publisher. And the book, of course, was The Story of Ruby Bridges. It was published in 1995. Yep, so she was really tickled because she got to see her again, you know, because she was very important, obviously. But she got her through that year. And, of course, you know, I don't know how she was an amazing child. She really was.
Yeah. We also were talking earlier with Jeff Foster, the author of For Which We Stand, talking about politics and government and how mm-hmm. our government works. And Jeff and his students are activists, too, in the anti-gun violence. And so I thought this was an appropriate time to talk about Ruby Bridges and Through My Eyes.
And in August of 1963, 250,000 Americans joined in a civil rights march on Washington. So things changed then a little bit those years, thank goodness.
Yep, but there's still a lot of progress to be made.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it isn't just in the South anymore.
Well, it never was just in the South. It's just that it was worse there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Mom, do you have a quote for us today?
Oh, are we done already?
Yep.
Yep, I guess I do. This is actually this is in the book from Ruby. I now know that experience comes to us for a purpose. And if we follow the guidance of the Spirit within us, we will probably find that the purpose is a good one.
Mm. Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Okay, bye-bye.